on those the House and Senate side. And those are Senators Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Edward Kennedy, and Christopher Dodd, as well as Representatives Rose Delaro, George Miller, Carolyn Maloney, and Lynn Ruefly. We very much appreciate their leadership on these issues. So without further ado, I'm going to pass it over to Karen Cornbury to provide some introduction to today's briefing. Thank you.
I want to just, since this is the last briefing, I want to thank Heather and Liz for just having done an incredible job putting this briefing series together. And yeah. You know, they've just done a great job. I think it seems, maybe you can't tell if you're in the audience, but I'm sure I speak for the congressional offices. So I've just been amazed at how, not only how informative they've been, but how professionally they've pulled them together and humor and grace and great inclusiveness. It's been a pleasure to work with you guys. Thank you very much. And the reason these briefings are so important is I think those of us on the Hill really need the tools to continually make the case for how important these issues are, how urgent they are, and how much we need policy change. Because strangely enough, this issue is still marginalized by the mainstream debate. I was looking at the evening news, NBC Evening News, and this week, and there was a segment on women and how they don't have enough savings in retirement, and so they can't retire, they're going to bankruptcy. It didn't even mention, it was just taken as a given that the reason was that these women had taken time out of the workplace. That's why they didn't have the savings that their ex-husbands had. And the policies just weren't there to help them. They'd gotten less in Social Security, they had less in pensions, they'd earned less. It's just taken as a given. Having a child is seen as a private choice. There's no evaluation of how the economy punishes you. And our policies that are so out of date do the same for doing the right thing. So obviously we all know better. We know that parents should have other options. We know that in part from this briefing series, that they should be able to stay home with a sick child or find affordable child care. They shouldn't be punished when they take a part-time job or refuse to work overtime. And we know that these issues have real costs for the most vulnerable in our society. We all have to just take that sense of urgency and communicate it, I think, more broadly. And these briefings are so wonderful because they give us the tools to do that. And we're closing the series with an amazing lineup to help us do that. The women who are on this panel, as Michelle will tell you, are not only pioneers on these issues, but they've been leaders as well. They haven't only identified them, but they've really gone into the arena and pushed them forward and made real differences in people's lives. So it's just fantastic that we're closing with this. And the other thing that's wonderful about this panel is that they're all optimistic. After all their years working on these issues, that good policies can make a difference. So I'm really looking forward to this panel. I hope you will, too. And I have the pleasure of turning it over to Michelle Marnhagen, working for another leader on issues of importance to American families.
All the issues.
On all issues. So, Michelle, thank you.
Hi. Well, hopefully you can all hear me. So I'm ostensibly the moderator for today's panel, which is a great privilege for myself. I'm the Benefits and Labor Counsel for the Democrats on the Education and the Workforce Committee, the ranking Democrat, who is George Miller, who has been a leader on so many issues over the years. And luckily, he's still very young and youthful and, you know, wants to continue to fight for many years to come. Just quickly before I, you know, introduce our great speakers, I started working in Congress back in 1984 when the issue of the day was just starting to be unpaid leave and the Family Medical Leave Act. And so maybe sort of also on this theme of somewhat trying to be optimistic that, you know, we started out the Family Medical Leave Act. There was a Republican president. There was a Republican Senate. We did have the House, so at least we had, you know, one chamber. But, you know, not all of the, you know, signs were auspicious for starting to lead this debate of and a discussion and a legislative dialogue about how to improve the lives of working women and all families. But I guess a little bit not to underestimate the challenges. It took us close to 10 years. To enact the Family Medical Leave Act, but it was a combination of having outside advocates who were dedicated and committed to discussing and advancing these issues. It was, you know, working both at the federal level and the state level. It was building coalitions, you know, constantly expanding who was involved in these issues. It wasn't just the women's groups. It wasn't just the consumer advocates. People worked very hard to bring AARP in, bring in the religious community, so that, you know, you wound up pulling everybody into this discussion about issues that affect, you know, all families in America. And also sort of a little bit now leading into our speakers, it was also, you know, it was also, you know, working with employers, because, you know, trying to find the progressive employers, the employers who are doing the right thing, who were interested in doing the right thing, to sort of join with us. But also finally, it was also having the research and the data that was also documenting where the problems were, what's working, what's not working, how changes in policy could benefit everyone. And speakers that we have today were very instrumental in working on that issue, as well as many other issues that have come up since then, having to do with work and family. So I will just quickly introduce the three speakers. I guess there are more detailed biographies of everyone in their packets, and so just quickly, our first speaker is Professor Eileen Applebaum, who is currently professor at Rutgers University and the director of the Center for Women and Work. I think she's going to talk primarily about a lot of the economic issues facing working women and where the relationship between work and the economy. Our second speaker is Dr. Heidi Hartman, who is president of the Institute for Women's Policy Research. I think she's also going to talk about the different policies that are at play in the workplace and how they, you know, work for, you know, help companies be successful. And finally, our last speaker is Kate Kahan? Elkhan, sorry. The extra A threw me off. Who is director of Work and Family Programs at the National Partnership for Women and Families, that has been instrumental on, you know, so many pieces of legislation having to do with women, working women, and American families. And she'll talk about what's going on both at the federal and the state level, and sort of how different national and local policies interact. And so that leading off with Professor Applebaum.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and I'm very grateful to CIFRA and the Senate and House offices that have organized this briefing. Many of all of this opportunity to talk about a really important issue. I have two things with my time doesn't run out that I want to talk about, and the first is, I think, a little bit as sort of the indicator about the national economy and what I think needs to be done globally, and then I have a few minutes at the end. I want to talk about what we've learned about how to structure state family leave so that it can be win-win for workers and for businesses, and so that unions and women's groups can also support it if we don't find any way to do. So the first thing I want to talk about is the fact that, as I think everybody in this room probably knows, the American economy is extremely productive. We are used to walking around, you know, with these long faces that, oh my gosh, this is a way of beginning to do anything. But in fact, we're much richer than we were 30 years ago. In terms of productivity, workers produce 70% more than they did 30 years ago. And the other big increase has been in hours worked. I think everybody in this room is aware of the fact that in the last 30 years, there's been a tremendous increase in the employment of women, and especially in the employment of mothers with young children. And the result is that economic pie in this country is much, much larger than it was a generation ago. The problem is that family income hasn't risen nearly as rapidly as family hours of work. In fact, they've lagged substantially behind family hours of work. So families are working much more, but they're seeing only a very small increase in pay. And they are working without affordable quality childcare, without paid sick days, without paid family leave, without control of their work schedules, all the things that families need in order to be able to manage the work and family life. And the result is that despite working harder, families face greater stress and greater economic insecurity. So despite the fact that the pie is much bigger, as the President always likes to point out, the economic insecurity of the largest working families is also more acute. And this dichotomy, in my view, is the central contradiction confronting the U.S. economy. So we do need to do something about it. Now, it's true that we have to move to more sensible tax and budget policy, but in a country as rich as ours, we can afford to put people first. And so we can afford the investments that we need to deal with global warming support, bound for work and family. And of course, the federal long-term crisis in healthcare financing, which I know everybody in this room is aware of, but also has to be addressed, both for the physical health of the country and for the physical health of the working families. The second point I want to make is that the U.S. is becoming an hourglass economy. If you look at BLS's projections for where the job opening will be in 2014, you will find that 40% of job openings are projected to be in low-wage jobs that require either short or very short on-the-job training. So we have a low-wage, low-skill equilibrium in a large part of our labor market, and we're not really thinking about how we're going to address it. That's a much bigger question than we've come to talk about today. I know I didn't have that through for another time, but all I want to point out here is that these low-wage jobs, which are not going anywhere, they are not going to be excluded, are women's jobs. They're in child care, home health aide, nurse's assistant, retail clerk, hotel housekeeper, food prep, food server. That's where job openings are going to be. Workers in these jobs are really stuck in a low-wage environment. And so both because families are working more hours and because we have this large low-wage sector of the labor market, working families really need a bill of rights that establishes minimum employment standards. And what I mean by minimum employment standards are livable wages, universal health care, affordable quality child care, paid sick days and vacations, paid family and medical leave, and some control over work schedules so that you can deal with the things that come up. Teacher meetings, taking to the doctor, and so on. So that's what I'm here to really push, that we need some sort of working family bill of rights to fairly reward all of the work the families are doing and to begin to make a dent in this low-wage labor market. We need to do more than that to the low-wage labor market, but that's a good start. I also want to emphasize that we need a work and family bill of rights for a second important reason, something that I don't think people who think about working families typically focus on. The trade deficit in the United States is now running at an $820 billion annual rate, or more than 6% of GDP. This is three times, actually now more than three times, as large as the federal budget deficit. So we all focus on the federal budget deficit, but who amongst us is paying as much attention to the trade deficit? What economists know, in the famous quote, saying Kurt Stein, Republican Council of Economic Advisors, if a thing can't continue, something can't continue, it's too long. And so at some point, we will need to pay the piper. Right now, we are at a country where we are consuming 6% more than we produce. When we have to make this balance out at the end of the day, as a country, we are going to have to consume less than we produce as a country. And the question is, whose consumption is going to be hit? Well, it won't be the lowest wage people, because if you're already a minimum wage worker with no benefits whatsoever, basically, there's nothing left to cut. Your consumption can't go down any further than it already is. And so my concern is that it is the lower middle class, the middle class. This is where the cuts in consumption will come. Well, a working family bill of rights that gives you a living wage, universal health care, affordable child care, pay time off to care, these things will make it possible for the middle class to better face whatever is going to happen when our trade imbalance needs to be addressed. So I really think it's important for that reason as well. I see that I'm out of time, and I don't want to hold up the panel, but in question and answer, if you ask me how should we structure pay family leave, I'm happy to address that question. Thank you.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. I also would like to thank Speaker for organizing this series of briefings and all the Senate and House sponsors of the event. I also hope that all of you know that the Institute for Living Quality Research, which is now going on 20 years old, provides research and information on a variety of issues that come before Congress, including work and family issues, of course. course, that we're discussing today, but also issues like poverty, welfare, equal pay, health care, and so on. We have a very large website, and all our publications can be downloaded for free. And if you can't find what you need on the website, you can call us, and we'll try to find the information that you need. I want to focus my remarks today on one proposed bill that has been introduced into Congress, the Healthy Families Act, which does provide for paid sick leave of up to 7 days per year for all workers, and one can use the sick leave for family care as well as for home illness, and also for routine doctor's visits and for dental health care, which is often for workers who have 6 days of time being covered. So the Healthy Families Act is what I want to focus on, because I think it's a good example of how the lowest paid workers are exactly the ones that don't have what we think of as basic benefits, and how taking the high road rather than the low road, as Eileen discussed, is actually something that would be good for the economy and would even help employers. So we have a situation where many employers aren't providing paid sick leave, and it's actually costing them money, although they don't know about it. So that's what I'm going to talk about today. I'd like to make three major points about the paid sick leave bill, as I mentioned, known as the Healthy Families Act. It's been proposed in two congressional sessions now, I believe, and that will surely be proposed in the next session as well. While the unpaid family medical leave act took us almost 10 years, we're hoping for less time for the paid sick leave bill, the Healthy Families Act. First, I guess I would just emphasize that having paid sick leave is the most basic work and family right that you could possibly have, and it is one that also many workers lack, and we'll turn to some data on that. Second point that I'm going to make is that even if you have paid sick leave, you more than likely can't use it for preventive health care or caring for sick family members. And the third point is that providing a reasonable amount of paid sick leave doesn't cost employers all that much, a mere $20 billion, but we'll go into the details. And even that estimate is outweighed by the estimated cost savings that employers would experience because of reduced care numbers. There would also be reduced spread of illness to other workers. But turnover is actually the biggest cost savings they would experience. You should all have the handout. It's a red fact sheet. It's a news release. It's red and black. Could you, in the fact that we hold it up for everyone to see? Actually, you should have one. If you don't have it, share with your neighbor or raise your hand, and we'll try to get one. Let's take a look at figure two in your handout on how many people lack this basic benefit. Nearly half of American workers lack the right to even a single day of paid sick leave. For private sector workers, it's only about 45% of that paid sick leave, which you can see in figure two. And for part-time workers, it's only 15% that have it. And one of the amazing things about this number is that it took us so long for this number to get our attention. When people come visit you from other countries, what are the things that are always amazed about the U.S.? Oh, we don't have universal health care. First point. Second point. I can't believe middle-class parents are spending all this money to send their kids to college. That's the second point. I get that higher than three kids that all went to private college. Third point, if they get that far, you don't have paid sick leave. There's no law requiring paid sick leave. If you're sick, if you don't have it, you just what? Hope you have some savings. They can't understand it. That's all wrapped up in their National Health Insurance Program, their National Retirement Program, their National Employment Insurance Program. It includes paid sick leave. So it took us a long time, I think, as a group of people working on the issues to realize how bad this problem was. Part of the problem might be that since 1986, coverage has actually been falling. It's fallen in our full report, you can take a look at it. 70% of private, medium, and large-sized firms used to provide paid sick leave. By 1997, that had fallen to 55%, even for many medium and large-sized firms. Turning to table two, one of my favorite facts is you can look at the rate of coverage in different industries and see that the industries with the most personal contact with you as a customer is abysmally low. The retail trade, 50% have no paid sick leave. In entertainment and recreation, 60% have no paid sick leave. In miscellaneous service industries, which includes child care and beauty salon, 69% don't have paid sick leave. And in food service, my very favorite, 86% of workers don't have paid sick leave. So this means that every time that a weight person is coughing, they're coughing on your loop. These are all industries that serve the public or work closely with our most vulnerable populations, such as children and even the elderly. Nursing homes also don't provide a lot of safety to their workers. And an important point as an economist is to remember that those employers who are not currently providing paid sick days are imposing costs on all the rest of us. And it's time that they pay their fair share. And when they do, our economy will actually experience some net productivity gains. Before turning on to the cost and benefit estimates, I do want to talk about the uses of paid sick leave. As you can see this in the next table in the handout, right under the one we've just been talking about, shows that you can't use the paid sick leave that you do have for preventive health services or taking care of sick family members. In fact, only about 30% of workers who actually have paid sick leave can use it to go to a doctor or to take care of a sick family member. So that means about a sixth of all workers have any access to paid sick leave that they can use for those purposes. And if you look at figure 4, it's exactly the lowest paid workers, as I mentioned, who have the least right to use that sick leave for family care. Only 10% of low-risk workers can use their paid sick days to take care of their own children. Now, I want to turn now to my final topic, the cost to business of providing a modest amount of paid sick leave, and point out that they are overweight by the estimated benefits. This is in the last table in that handout, table 1. And we estimate that for each covered worker, it will cost employers $5.98 per week to give this new paid sick leave benefit, or about $1.20 per covered worker per workday, per 5 days per week. That is fairly low. The gain and the benefits that the businesses would get for this are $8.38 a week. Now, the benefits outweigh the cost. The benefits mainly come from reduced turnover. They also come from eliminating low productivity when sick workers actually try to go to work. And in case you didn't know, there's a name for that. It's called presenteeism. And I personally am often guilty of presenteeism. When you insist on going to work when you're sick, it's constant. And I don't do it because I don't have to take sick days. I do it because, you know, I think I'm indispensable. None of us are indispensable. You should stay home and not make other people sick. But so many workers without paid sick leave, for them, that choice is a very difficult one. So it's mainly from reducing turnover. Workers who have paid sick days do not leave their jobs as much. They're not forced to go to work because they have the right to take a day off and come back. And it is also from eliminating the low productivity of people like me who come to work even when we're sick, and it's from reducing the spread of the flu. Now, there's an additional societal benefit of reduced nursing home days that we were able to estimate. Because if you're able to take off a little bit of time and attend to a working parent, an elder parent, you will have that parent in nursing homes for fewer days. So this is all in Table 1. Economy-wide, the cost is $20.2 billion per year, and the benefits are $28.4 billion per year. When we say that the benefits outweigh the cost, what we're saying is that it's more economically efficient for us to make a change. If we pass this law, employers will be forced to provide paid sick days that will reduce turnover costs to them, and they will actually have the net benefit. That it will be cheaper for society as a whole to pass this law than it would be to continue the way we have it now, which is with no paid sick days for half of our workers and consequently high turnover for those workers. Just to talk about how many workers benefit, it's 65.8 million workers. 46 million will get coverage we don't have any now, and 19 million will get the use of either more days or more uses. Some workers who have paid typically have only 1 or 2 days a year. This would improve it to 7. Where do the low costs come from? It comes from the reality that most workers don't take off much time for illnesses in a given year. Would anyone care to guess what the most common number of days taken off for illness is in a given year by all workers together? Most common number of days taken off? 0. That is the most common number of days taken off. 0. When workers do have paid sick leave, and if you cap it at 7 days, which we would still in terms of payments that's required, workers take off an average of 1.8. Workers who don't have any paid sick leave at all take off 1.3 days. That's half a day extra that this bill would allow people to take off. In other words, if you don't have any paid sick leave, you really don't minimize it. If you have some paid sick leave, sure, you're going to take off more. And employers out there are going to tell you, we're going to take off millions of days. A half a day for workers. That's the amount of extra sick leave time that people will take if those will now be paid. And that partly accounts for the relatively low cost of $20 billion. If $20 billion doesn't sound like a low number to you, remember that our GNP, which I could not keep up with last time I looked, was $13 billion. It's probably much higher now. $13 trillion is probably much higher now. But when we did these numbers in 2003, it was 0.3% of total payroll costs. So 0.3%, that dollar 20 a day, that 0.3% of total payroll costs in the U.S. economy overall. So $20 billion might sound like a big number in cost, but it's actually fairly small for such an important worker benefit. Just in conclusion, then, I would say that everyone benefits from paid sick leave. It is truly an equitable win-win situation. Employers benefit because the turnover costs fall. Unproductive workers stay home, don't affect others. Workers benefit because they don't lose income and they can take off time when they need to. Children will benefit from better care because their parents will be able to take care of them. Taxpayers will benefit from less nursing home care. And customers, like us, will benefit from less spread of illness in restaurants and hotels and other places. There are also many benefits you could measure. There's not really enough data out there. We were able to measure the spread of the flu, but there isn't a lot of data out there on the spread of other communicable diseases to co-workers and customers. We weren't able to get an estimate of effect to recuperations that help out from reduced public assistance. We could only look at nursing homes. We couldn't look at reduced welfare payments and other things because people won't lose their jobs. And, of course, increased financial stability of families. What is the value of that? We really don't have a good way of measuring that, too. So, again, on the bottom line, it's a win-win. It's economically efficient. And that means that passing something like the Healthy Families Act would actually improve productivity in the economy overall. I would just like to say that it's not always that you can say that something that's morally right is also good business and good for businesses. But this is one.
Hi. My name is Kate. I work for the National Partnership for Women and Families. I'm willing to do additions to the Women and Families team. I actually came to Washington almost 3 years ago to work on the Senate Finance Committee after a history of working on economic justice issues in Montana. So this is my favorite room in the capital because it's the Mike Mansfield room, and boy, did we miss Mike Mansfield. An amazing man in Montana. And ironically, I'm sitting shaking because I'm freezing. And I forgot for 2 years, I couldn't believe it, that I moved here from Montana and I froze the whole time I was in the Senate. It was so cold in this building, but the sitting shaking is actually not going to be so the National Partnership for Women and Families works on a range of family leave issues. And I think we're most well known for our coalition efforts leading the way towards the Family Medical Leave Act. Understanding past, which I'm going to move to. And it really is our only, it's our first and only significant advance in this area. And I think that's worth mentioning before I end up being all optimistic and telling you who I am to make the situation better. And I think actually I just want to step back and say thank you to my fellow panelists and also to our champions in Congress. Because for us, this is a women's issue, it's a feminist issue, it's a women's rights issue, and I'm grateful to be here with great co-conspirators, and I also do think we need to acknowledge the changes we do have on the national level, of course we really do have, because they have done a lot of work to help this issue gain visibility. Representatives Miller, DeLauro, Stark, and Woolsey, just to name a few, and in the Senate, Dodd, Kennedy, Clinton, and Obama, of course. So thank you all for all you're doing. So death on the leg, 12 weeks of unpaid leave for a specific set of workers who work for employers that employ 50 or more employees. So that leaves out 40% of the workforce. And to be specific, most of those people probably need leave very badly and cannot afford to take it, and we're really talking about lower income women And I want to be clear about that because that's really a priority for us as a national partnership, is to keep saying out loud when we're talking about our poor women and poor families. And I think to also even take a bigger step back, there's been this great Harvard research done about where we fit in globally and who's doing what, and are we really not competitive if we offer better benefits and in a competitive market and all of that. This Harvard study that came out in 2004 found that, in fact, we are one of four countries out of 168 in the world that do not offer any paid maternity or paternity leave. Four countries. We're at the very bottom. Those other countries are Lesotho, Papua New Guinea, Swaziland, and us. So that's the huge picture. And what we need is action. I think the public is ready. Whenever we start talking about these issues, whether it's paid leave, whether it's paid sick days, more flexibility for families and workers, the public loves it. They absolutely, it holds through the roof. It's over time it holds through the roof too. It's not just moments in time. In the past 10 years, when we've been asking people about this, and our colleagues have been asking people about this, people support this happening. We're just a little bit out of step. But I think that there is gracious momentum gaining around this issue. And that's very, very helpful. And I also think there's a lot going on the state level. And I'm going to try to do this in a quick, concise way where I'm going to talk a little bit about both what's happening on the federal and the state level. And do it sort of thematically. Looking at the 109th Congress, mostly 2005, and also 2005 state legislatures, and what's been going on with the flavor of some of the policy out there. There are three types of proposals. There's paid sick days, which is a minimum labor standard. There's also, in that area of paid sick days, there's something called a flexibility standard, which says if you already have paid sick days, you should be able to use them for your family members and your kids if they get sick. And there's paid family medical leave act, or excuse me, paid family medical leave. Through, as I mentioned, you should ask her this question because she's far more eloquent than I am. Through expanding programs that already exist or creating programs that make insurance models, basically. Whether expanding a disability insurance program, if you have it in your state, or if you have it in your state, to include family reasons, if you have a child, or you adopt a child, or someone in your family is sick, or creating a family leave insurance pool, which is where you pay in for an amount to an insurance fund, and then you're able to use that if you have family needs arise and take time off of your state. And then expanding access to the Family Medical Leave Act as it exists. So making sure that there are more people who actually have access to it, that's the 50% that don't, and that it can be used for more reasons than just the strict, sort of rather narrow set of reasons that we have now in law. So on case days, Heidi did a great job of laying all of the great research that IWCR has done out, and we use it every single day to reinforce the world high ground that we have on this issue, but also just, I think the figures are amazing. The other thing is that people are confounded that we don't, in our own country, as well as Heidi mentioned globally, that we don't have paid sick days. People don't, and it's true. There's far too many people that don't have any paid sick days. And it's a huge, huge problem. And there's an easy solution. And for us, this is really a minimum labor standard. This is very similar in the way we think about this as the minimum wage. And it also seems to be very similar in the way the public thinks about it, in that it holds very similarly. People are absolutely supportive of the existing minimum wage. People absolutely think that businesses should be required to provide some minimum pay ticket for their workers. So this is our favorite issue too, because when Heidi's talking about the statistics and the numbers of people who don't have them, again, who we're talking about are low-income women. A low-income women of color are the people we're talking about. They do not have access to the state. And far greater numbers than anyone else. So we are proud to be the coalition that has about 150 organizations, of national organizations that are working to promote visibility and pass the Healthy Families Act, which Kennedy is the role of our championing. And this is great to pick up on in the field as well. There's really a lot, there are a lot of people that are talking about this. There are a lot of states that are either preparing for action on it or have had some action on it. In 2005, in the legislative session, both Connecticut and Massachusetts tried to get some something going in their state to promote visibility around the need for paid sick days. And we had one citywide vote in Madison, Wisconsin in May, actually lost by one vote, for to cover all city workers in Madison to make sure that they had paid sick days. And there's actually our first citywide ballot initiative is coming up in California, San Francisco, and there will be a vote on November 7th, which is really exciting. And it's actually a great proposal that covers a lot of people and makes sure that people have close to 9 days of paid days every San Francisco worker. So that's really exciting to keep your eye out for that. And also here at home in D.C., folks are preparing to do something here in D.C. in January. It's a paid sick and safe day, so it actually accommodates people who are recovering from domestic violence, whether it's court appearances or other recovery activities, but they've actually covered them with paid sick days as well. So that will be coming up in January. There are also a list of states that are doing this. Montana, Wisconsin, Vermont, and it looks like Maryland are going to be doing something on paid sick days here in the next year. So that's really exciting. There are also 8 states worth mentioning that have this flexibility standard, which says if you already have paid sick days, you already have them, then you should be able to use them for your kids and for your family members. Because that's a critical sort of economic justice and work-life balance issue, for sure. So there are a number of states that are trying to get that done, and there are 8 states that already have some flexibility standard built in. So paid family medical leave. Again, this is gets tremendous support. It's like 90% of the public thinks that this is a really good idea. California has the only paid leave program in the country right now. And it's quite successful from what we can tell. It's employee funded, so people pay about the cost of a couple copies a week to put in their money into this pool so that when you have family needs arise, you can actually take them off and get some portion of your pay. There's also a proposal that Alive, as far as we can tell, in Massachusetts that just came up that's very, very similar to this. And they were here over the summer, and it's wage replacement for 12 weeks. It, again, is a very minimal cost to employees, but it's employee funded. And expected in the Senate for in Massachusetts sometime in the near future, so keep your eye out for that. In Washington, New York, New Jersey, and Illinois, there are coalitions working to create this family leave insurance model that we talked about, and hopefully that we'll talk about even more, which is that insurance for people paying for. And on the federal level, there's some activity to try and expand uses of FMLN for whether it's for military families, federal workers, or Senator Dodd's bill, which provides grants for pilot programs in states and expands what institutes for FMLA, including school activities, which is another really important thing. Some parents can take time off to go to their school conferences or school activities. That's a basic issue, but amazingly, people don't necessarily have that right or that access. And I'm going to close here, but finally, I just want to mention a bill that's close to my heart from my experience working in Montana. There's a program specifically geared towards low-income women that was actually created by members of an organization we used to work for who were all welfare moms, called the Absence and Care Program, which is specifically geared towards childcare eligible and sometimes welfare eligible families and allows them to care for their infants at home and get in lieu of a childcare subsidy. And there's some federal activity, there's statewide activity on this, both in Montana, New Mexico, and Minnesota, and there's also federal activity. Clinton and DeLauro introduced the bill before this, which we set called the Choices in Child Care Act, and it's a version of that and take care of that specific at that low-income family. So we appreciate that as well.
So I'd like to, I'm sure all of us would like to thank all of our speakers. And before you, you know, start asking them questions, though, CFER has like asked if maybe some of the staffers who represent members who've been helping sponsor these briefings might want to say a few words about things your bosses are working on and what they're committed to. So I see Senator Kennedy's office here, Senator Obama, Senator Dodd. Just because I'm up here, I'll, you know, just briefly start off. Some of you may know, actually, George Miller has spent a lot of his time, he's been actively fighting to raise the minimum wage, which almost like family leave, had not been raised for almost 10 years. So, you know, sort of starting from the fundamental belief that workers, if they can't support their families financially, some of these other issues don't even come to play. So he's on the front lines. And some of you may have heard, I guess this is like kind of trickling out, that Mrs. Pelosi has, I haven't heard this directly, but I've heard it from a number of sources, is now saying that if the Democrats win the House in November, that there will be a 100 hours action plan from the Democrats, that we will pass our key priorities in the Democratic agenda within the first 100 hours of Congress. As a working mom, I don't really know how they're counting the 100 hours. I don't know if it's like round the clock or just like we're just limited to 8 hours a day. I'm a little bit nervous about that because I do want to do homework with my children at night. But we'll, for the cause, at least for 100 hours, give it our all. And so minimum wage is one of the things that is at the top of at least the House Democratic agenda. I'm sure it's at the Senate Democratic agenda as well. George Miller has also been an active fighter on making college more affordable, trying to get student loan interest costs down so that working parents who have, you know, when your children reach college age, the family won't be bankrupted by sending your children to college, you know, that more and more young adults will be able to go to college and expand their job opportunities. He's also been very active fighter on retirement security issues, hoping that when those of us finally make it through our child-rearing years, that we can enjoy a prosperous retirement, or at least a comfortable one. And so those are some of the issues that he's been spending a lot of his time on. I guess I'm just hopeful, before I turn over to my colleagues, that, you know, whatever happens in November, that, you know, we can, you know, sort of once the fallout and people assess, you know, what the situation is, that, you know, we can sort of use some of the energy that I think these forums have started to, you know, I think all of us need to have regular meetings to sort of really start brainstorming, really start strategizing about what are the most pressing issues, what, you know, what can we do, what should we do for working families. That, you know, certainly, you know, you've heard there's a very large agenda, but, you know, if we're united, if we're active, you know, we can make a lot of progress, and we need to get that energy back that we, you know, used to have it. I, you know, just unfortunately, you know, the problems that are facing this nation are, you know, ever expanding, but, you know, all of us know that, you know, families are struggling, workers are struggling, and, you know, each of us who are committed to making things better, you know, needs to start being a lot more active and thoughtful in trying to make things happen. But so I don't know if any of you, you know, others want to speak. I guess I'm, oh, okay, good, I'll turn it to Holly Fechner with Senator Kennedy.
Thanks so much, Michelle. Holly Fechner with Senator Kennedy, and I'm here with my colleague Portia Wu, and we both work on these issues for the Senator. I could spend probably all day talking about his working family agenda, but what I want to do is talk very briefly about a few of the specific work family issues that we're working on. We are so thrilled to work with Heather and have this kind of program so everybody can talk more about work family issues. And obviously we have an amazing team and coalition behind us for our legislation on the Healthy Families Act for paid sick days. With Kate and Heidi and Eileen, what a team. We've been working for this for a few years. I think we've really reached critical mass in terms of the education we've done of people. What we need now are co-sponsors. We really could use all of your bosses to step up to the plate and contact us about being a part of this effort, because I think it really is the future of work-family issues and something that is attainable in the next number of years. We also have a few other pieces of legislation in development, and we'd love people's feedback about them and also the opportunity to work with other offices on them. One has to do with this issue of flexibility, making sure that people have the opportunity to have a conversation with their employer about having workplace flexibility. I think what we've seen is that there really are a lot of opportunities for people, employers and employees, to work together to come up with a schedule that works for both of them. So we have developed legislation on flexibility, which is pretty much done, and we're hoping to introduce it in the next Congress. Another issue we work particularly with Heidi on is this problem where it seems like we're not collecting all the data that we need to about some of these basic problems. And it seems so basic, it really does, but all of our wonderful agencies, Census Bureau, Bureau of Labor Statistics, they just haven't focused in the way that we need to on collecting all of the relevant information. Obviously, this is something that Heather has contributed a lot to our thinking, too, about this issue. So we'd like to pull together something, and that seems like it should be a fairly short-term, doable kind of project. The only other issue I wanted to add is that we have gotten some feedback, particularly from state advocates, that it would be helpful to have something which is sort of an omnibus bill. Now, you know, I don't know, that's sort of a legislative call, I think, for all the people in this room about whether it would be helpful to pull a lot of these issues together and have something that ties them together. We, in our office, we did an outline of what that would look like, and would love to talk with more people. So please don't hesitate to get in contact with us. Portia and I are both on the committee staff, Health, Education, and Labor and Pensions Committee, and we are at 224-5441, if you'd like to talk to us.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thanks, Holly. I don't know. Karen, do you want to say anything more?
Hi, Karen
Sheehan,
Senator Dodd, Health Committee staff, and thank you. And all of you for all of your work you've done over the years. And Senator Dodd is very committed to continuing his work on all of these issues with all of his colleagues and all the state organizations, and also feels like it's really the time is right for things to really move. One of the things that was mentioned earlier was that Senator Dodd's Family and Medical Leave Expansion Act, which allowed access to more people to come to medical leave. Make 6 weeks of that leave paid, so because we know that so many families can't afford these. And Senator Dodd worked very closely with all the organizations and his colleagues and bringing business in and finding out what, you know, what businesses could agree to. And we think that there's a possibility to move paid leave along. It also includes time for school, as Kate mentioned, which is really important. Where in the No Child Left Behind Act, we require more parent involvement, but we need to have a workplace give parents more time to attend school activities. And it also expands some of the reasons for leave, including persons who are dealing with effects of domestic violence, and allowing to give them mental leave for that. Some other things that Senator Dodd is continuing to work on is access and quality of child care, which is central to parents working, including helping to ensure that child care workers who are among the lowest paid get the benefits and salaries that they need so they can recruit, train, and retain adequate quality, high-quality staff to help children be ready for school and online. Another thing that Senator Dodd is working on is has been a lot of campaigning for is after-school care, which is important for families. When their children are in school, they parents need to be able to know that their children are somewhere safe after school. Currently, the after-school caucus that Senator Dodd has with a bipartisan group of has 36 senators from both sides of the aisle, and above to have 100 senators to play that important step. Senator Dodd's parents and her children are working together in that coalition, and love to join if you haven't already. Also looking at moving forward on a lot of these proposals, the working family bill, right? And I mentioned many pieces of that are possible, and we should all, you know, work together and continue meeting and talking about these and putting together legislation that we think that could be removed. There are things I've heard from support for many of these ideas, and let's work on that. Including the tax relief for families, which is so central. One of the things that Senator Dodd has worked on and is looking at again is creating tax relief and child-dependent tax or tax credit, making that, expanding that and making it refundable, also to include tax credit for parents who stay on the bench to make sure that families have options. So those are just some of the things that we're working on. And would love to continue to work with everyone here and look forward to
I think we just have a couple other quick comments and then we'll turn over the questions. Oh, you have a comment.
I have a comment that when Kate was talking about the San Francisco bill, which will be on the ballot, right? It's a referendum on the ballot for paid sick leave for workers in San Francisco. The San Francisco Restaurant Association refused to come out against it. They said it is so popular, it would be nonsense for us to come out against it. So, I mean, that's pretty amazing, isn't it? And that's
if only we could get the National Restaurant Association to take that same position. Boy, that would be a feat. Wow. I'd be doing somersaults if I could do that there. Yeah. I think Karen would, sorry.
I'm Chelsea Mom. Yeah, I'm Chelsea Mom. It's under Cliff's office. I'm sorry. I think I'm guilty of what Heidi spoke about of attending work when sick. But I just wanted to expand a little bit on what Kate mentioned, because we were so fortunate. Centerson was so fortunate to have the partnership come to us and talk to us about what Montana has been doing and now in New Mexico and Minnesota and other places are trying to find creative ways to address the challenge of finding affordable, quality health care, because so many, where everyone in this room is like teaching to the choir. So the bill was just introduced right before recess. It's called the Choices in Child Care Act. It amends EPDBG to create a 5-7 state pilot program to give parents the option of either receiving child care or using a monthly stipend to care for their child at home. Because, you know, as we all know, the, one of the most critical things is not the for brain development. Excuse me. And so that's just one of the many initiatives we're working on. I think you're all well aware of all the members who are here today and all the great work that they do. But please feel free. I think what Holly said is definitely rings true about meeting ideas and co-sponsors. So feel free to reach me at 404-OBO. Thank you so much.
Finally,
yeah.
Some
The main thing that Barack Obama's been trying to do, I think, is use his bully pulpit to try to raise these issues and bring them into the mainstream of the debate. And he's, I just wanted to let you all know that he has a book coming out next week, and he's devoted a chapter to these family issues, speaking very personally as somebody who was very involved with some kids before he had got elected to the Senate, and talking about what it means for his family that has some resources, and so what he knows it means for families that don't have those same resources that are vulnerable families that he knows well, having worked in communities in Chicago. And as a traveler around the country, I'm going to talk about these a lot and lend his support to all the issues that the members who are more senior than him in the Senate have been pioneering. So, I'm going to let you know that. And also, I just like that one thing.
Sure.
About something that Kate said.
Luckily, because this is mostly a women organized event, we're on schedule.
Okay. So. I have a question, I guess, of the panel. It's a framing question. Something that just really struck me when Kate was talking, she said we have to keep remembering who we're talking about. That we're talking about single moms, that we're talking about low-income families, that we're talking about people of color. And I know that a lot of us were taken by the idea of, you know, talking to the middle class and trying to connect the middle class in terms of vulnerability, what was happening to lower income families. But if I found myself in the last year wanting to be much more specific and paint a real picture of exactly who we're talking about so that people don't say, well, it's not such a big problem to me, it can't be a big policy problem, or I have sick leave, so how big of an issue can it be? So I don't know what you all are saying, but I'm saying we need to do both. And I've certainly seen Senator Obama do both to really paint a picture so that people understand what's happening to the most vulnerable families, to women who are raising children or making huge economic sacrifices.
Can I stop for a second? Maybe actually just because my House colleagues now would also like to say a word.
Okay,
that can be like the lead-off question for all of you once we go to the questions. But I think just quickly, Letty Medeiros and someone from Mrs. Woolsey's office would like to just quickly talk about some of the House efforts, not to let the Senate dominate too much. So just a few closing words from some of my House colleagues, and then I think that's a great question, you know, for our three speakers to start off with. So, Letty.
Thank you. I'm Letty Medeiros, and I work for Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, and we're thrilled that this is our last series, and it's been sort of a wonderful experience. We also introduced the Choices in Child Care Act with Senator Clinton. We had introduced the bill in 2003, but we have revamped it, and I think we have a much stronger product now. We hope to get that going. We also have the Equal Paycheck Fairness Act about equal pay. Rosa has been introducing that for the past maybe 4 or 5 Congresses, and
maybe more.
Yeah. And they refused to give us even a hearing, so we hope to have this bill right up there next year. And we have introduced with Senator Kennedy the Healthy Families Act, which would guarantee a minimum of seven paid sick days. And Holly's here, so I'm not going to say more. She's the expert on that. So we do have a very good agenda for middle-class families, working families. And we just can't wait to be in a position to make some of this stuff happen. And I brought your colleagues, I'll put them out on the table.
Thank you.
I'll be very quick as well. I'm Lindsay McAllister from Congresswoman Woolsey's office, and just wanted to run through her main bill is H.R. 1589, the Balancing Act. And I did bring a handout because it is a rather large bill that tries to cover a lot of ground. But what it does is just runs the gamut through family-friendly workplace, child care assistance, in-school and after-school assistance with nutrition, family care, and paid leave. I'll leave the handouts outside so you can grab those, and you can reach me at 55.
Well, thanks, everybody. I guess, you know, this way you can just see that there is a broad, you know, and a diverse coalition of members of Congress on, you know, in the House and the Senate who care about these issues. I guess the hard part is just that there are so many issues to focus on. But I think probably, you know, now following up on what Karen, you know, asked, you know, turning things over to questions. You know, maybe start off with like Karen's first question. I think it's a very important question, trying to really talk about, you know, sort of how do we think about who are the women that we're, you know, and the families that we're trying to help here. You know, should we be focusing only on low income, middle class? How, you know, is it everyone? How do we talk about that and think about it? And so maybe Dr. Appleman, starting off with you.
Well, you know, with as Heidi pointed out, some 50% of workers don't have even any paid sick days. So this is, in my view, much more than a problem that only affects the working poor. Clearly, they lack many things, and for them, everything's a crisis. You know, a sick child, a car that breaks down. There's just no flexibility in their budget. But when we're talking about being able to take time off because you have a sick child, when we're talking about paid family and medical leave, these are issues that affect really a large swath of the population. You have to get into the professional or managerial classes before you really have people who, if they need to take paid family leave, essentially can use their paid vacation days. And of course, there's a large group of people for whom that is true. They're not really our target. They can afford good quality child care. They can self-finance their paid family leave. They probably need paid medical, although they might have short-term disability where they work. But it rises fairly high into the middle class, the people that we're talking about who need these protections and who would benefit. And if I could just say one word, the other question was on the table from the audience was Holly's question about do we need an omnibus bill? At the state level and our various coalitions, the reason that we're pushing for an omnibus bill is that without that, you end up dividing allies. So in New Jersey, for example, before we began speaking of this more broadly, when I spoke with the state Fed from the AFL-CIO and said, paid family leave is really important in New Jersey, they said, well, yes, it is, but you know, universal health care is our highest priority. By having an omnibus bill, which may perhaps has to be, you know, shaped in some way, pruned in some way, but something that takes the really high priority items like living wage, like universal health care, like quality child care, and like paid sick days, paid family leave, and puts them together, gives us a much stronger coalition. Otherwise, it's not that people will oppose it, but they sit on their hands. You need something out there that everybody says, my top issue is in there. That's my view of it.
Do you want to comment on Karen?
Yeah, I would say that, Karen, that both are possible. That is, that both speaking about them as the middle class, the need for the middle class, and a need for the working poor, you know, should be done. I think people are more open to talking about the working poor. There are lots of candidates are emphasizing inequality and the failure of the minimum wage to grow, the failure of living wages to, you know, be prevalent. So I think there is more, you know, just openness in society for understanding the problems of the working poor. And, you know, everybody, I think, cares about the quality of, you know, child care, children. And, however, I have heard, I believe it was from people in Washington State, that the way to really get your state legislature on these bills is to talk about the sick grandma. Are you telling me that I can't stay home to take care of my sick grandma? And you have a grandma, don't you? And that one is even perhaps more powerful. But I think, seriously, that people are very open to these issues now. Just looking at the data that I showed you before in Figure 4, even for the top two quartiles, the majority of workers cannot use their paid sick days for doctor visits or sick children. So it's both a middle class and a working class issue.
I'm so glad you asked that question.
Do you have feelings?
I maybe do. I actually think it's exactly the right question we need to be asking each other and we need to be talking about at length, because I think we've got a little ways to go to figure out how to get to talk about this in the public that resonates. And I think part of it is talking about it in a way that's a little bit more comprehensively engaging. And I think some of that is not just focusing on one or the other, but, you know, lower class or middle class or upper class, because everyone's got work and family struggles. And I think people would say that. And I think they may look a little bit different. And I think in some ways, I think this is my bias of working on with low-income moms in Montana for 11 years and, you know, getting them to vote and getting them civically engaged around creating policies that they wanted to see happen, that we need to look at women's work experience on a spectrum. And I think we need to talk about it as a workforce development issue. And if you look at even just minimum wage, the next breath out of our mouths, you know, is yes, we need an increase in minimum wage, and we need to talk about the quality of jobs that women need to stay in the workforce, be productive, and, you know, achieve this maybe untenable work-life balance issue. But what can we do? But I think not in a way that eliminates talking about, you know, the rest of the families that are also struggling with different complications, or just one step beyond the complication that low-income women are facing. But I think we owe it to the people that we're working on behalf of to talk about this in a more comprehensive way that does really acknowledge women's work life on a spectrum and sort of allows room for growth and movement and sustainability. And I think we're almost there, but not quite. And I think some of it does have to do with really being deliberate about who we're talking about. The last thing I'll say is, and from looking at what happened in Madison, we had that city, the first citywide ordinance, and it lost by one vote. And, you know, one of the things we learned from talking to the folks that were on the ground there was that people really did resonate when stories were told. The human face on the issue went a long way to getting some of those no votes to yes votes on the ordinance, and that there was needed, there's a clear sense that there's more of that was needed. And I think San Francisco, with their ballot initiative organizing, is really on top of that. And, you know, I think they're poised to win. If we've seen anything that's got momentum to win on paid sick days in the country, it's this. And, you know, I think that should speak volumes, really.
Okay. I'd like to turn it over to everybody. Everybody else who hasn't had a chance to speak yet, so please feel free to ask a question.
Hi, I'm Michelle Friedman with the Coalition of Human Needs. First, thanks to the organization as well as staff and members who have been working on these issues so hard for so long. I have partnered with some of the organizations in trying to get co-sponsors for the 7 days of paid sick leave, and one of the very first questions is about the cost-benefit analysis. So it's great that IWPR has done that. I want to ask a question. A big chunk of the savings seems to come from retention, lack of turnover, and I wonder, because I can visualize some of these same staffers wanting to unpack that a little bit, because we know there are a lot of reasons, of course, for turnover. So I'm just wondering what some of the assumptions are, because the reduction in turnover is a huge percentage of the savings, and what were the assumptions in coming up with that savings based on reduced.
Yeah, I'd be happy to address that. We had to use a lot of other people's research to come up with these estimates, and what we used there was a study specifically looking at voluntary turnover. One researcher had estimated that turnover falls by a very small amount, like 5% less turnover for workers who have paid sick leave compared to workers who don't. So even such a small decline in turnover has big cost savings. For the cost of what it costs to replace a worker, we use the Employment Policies Foundation. This is a conservative foundation that we don't often cite, but it is supported by the National Restaurant Association, among other groups. Employers support this group, and they said 25% of annual earnings is a typical cost of any turnover. So basically, I think using quite conservative estimates on how much turnover would be reduced, we came up with the $26 billion or so in savings there. And it doesn't even count the involuntary turnover. You know, if you have to quit your job, well, you don't exactly quit, you're fired. You know, a lot of jobs, you don't show up. It doesn't matter that you're sick. You don't show up, you're out. So we don't even measure that at all. I mean, basically, that's an irrational thing for an employer to do, to fire someone for being sick. Even low-wage sales, you know, a typical Walmart, I think, is probably a pretty good indicator of a low-wage sales job. If in the time that a new retail worker is learning that job, she or he loses customers and often mistakenly identifies which product the person wants, and it can lead also to undercharging for products and services. So that's, you know, even in an area where, you know, turnover doesn't matter. I mean, a lot of employers seem to think it doesn't matter. But these are the kinds of cost savings that they would experience if they enjoyed this lower turnover. So we have a full report on the website. I will tell you the number. It's up there, and it's, is it 252 or something like that? Where's my publications person? I'll tell it to you in a moment. But on our website, you can look under Work and Family. You can look under PDFs, under Publications, and you will find this one, B, as in boy, 248. And it's called Valuing Good Health, an Estimate of the Cost and Savings for the Healthy Families Act, and it's 21 pages.
Other questions?
One of the things that we do, at least in New Jersey, is we have to distinguish between paid sick days and paid medical leave. So we try not to use the word leave when we're using the word sick days. We're talking about the Health and Families Act because people find it confusing. Paid sick days is something that employers should be providing to all of their workers. A minimum of 7 such days is, as Heidi has pointed out, well within the affordability and on the cost-benefit basis, a win for employers. When you talk about paid family medical leave, this is something that, in fact, is rarely used by workers. These serious illnesses where you need to be out for a long time, a heart attack, a stroke, some very serious illness that you have or that a family member has, or the birth of a new child or a new child coming into the family, adopted or foster child. These are rare events in anybody's life. As a percentage of the workforce, it's a very small percentage, but these are critical events when they occur. And it's really important that people have access to income during those periods of time. And while these are rare events spread over the workforce, if you happen to be a hospital that employs a lot of young women as nurses or nursing assistants, it's not so rare for you. And so to require employers to pay this really puts employers at a disadvantage based on who their workforce is and so on, and provides incentives that we don't like for not hiring women. We still have the bulk of the care responsibilities. And we're the only ones who give birth. So based on those two things, we would like this to be social insurance. It's very affordable, spread out over everybody. It would be very expensive for some employers to try to provide on their own. So that's the first thing. And then in terms of how to structure it, we've learned a lot from all the battles that we've lost. from the one that we won in California. The first point is the old idea was to make it part of unemployment insurance. We already have a social insurance scheme. Why not make it part of UI? And this turns out to be bad for at least two reasons. The first is it drives a wedge between unions and those who advocate for families, because unions feel very strongly that UI needs to be there. If there's a recession, we're all going to need to collect our unemployment insurance, and they're reluctant to see it used for anything else. And employers object to it even more strenuously than they ordinarily object to things, because UI is experience rated. And so you have a lot of women taking leave, and how are you going to handle that? And it has nothing to do with the workplace or the employer. So it just creates unnecessary, excessive opposition. The next thing that we learned is that there's no reason to go to the mat over what appears to be a fairness issue. Shouldn't this cost be shared equally among employers and employees? I am an economist. It's too long a story now, but I'm happy to give this little lecture whenever people ask. Economists will tell you it does not matter who you write into the law that will pay for it. Supply and demand will determine who actually pays for it. You can easily see this. If you work for IBM in Austin, Texas, where there's very low payroll taxes and they want to move you to the Silicon Valley facility where the payroll taxes are very high, what do? Well, they raise your pay. If you get an executive to make that move, the company raises your pay to cover the higher taxes in California. So even though you're paying it out of your pay, because that's what the law requires, your employer has paid it because they get the money for it. So there's no point in going to the mat over how the law is written. And there are many, many advantages we have learned by having workers pay the whole thing themselves. First of all, we get to determine who is eligible. You want domestic partners? Fine. You don't have to fight with employers over it. They're not paying? You don't ask them their opinion. No carve-out for small employers. Why should there be a carve-out for small employers? No employer is paying into this fund. So why do we need to carve-out for small employers? You can make it up to 12 weeks if you want. They settled for 6 weeks in California because they hadn't figured this whole thing out yet, but in New Jersey, we're asking for 12 weeks. We're paying for it. We're willing to pay for it. Give us the 12 weeks. And the latest calculation is that it's 26 cents a week. Our minimum wage is 7.15 an hour. So for a minimum wage worker, it's 26 cents a week. For the premium, we don't talk about it as taxes. These are insurance premiums for which you get an insurance benefit. And for the average worker, it's less than a dollar. And if you're making $94,000 a year or more, it's under $2 a week for you. So, you know, people want it. And also, if we're in charge, we make the wage base the Social Security wage base and not the unemployment insurance wage base. In D.C., the uninsurance fund wage base is less than $10,000. So low-wage workers pay it on 100% of their income, and the rest of us pay it only on the first $10,000 in D.C. In my state of New Jersey, it's $25,000. But because employers have to pay it, they fight really hard to keep the wage base low. The way we get this really low premium for all the workers is we make the wage base the Social Security wage base. There's no additional work. Everybody has to do the payroll, has to take out the Social Security. Make it the first $94,000 that everybody earns. It's fair, it's low. These are the reasons that we want it. And then there are safeguards for employers, even if I would like not to have these safeguards, but this is how we get to the win-win. The first is that in California and also in our New Jersey proposals, the first week is unpaid. You have to realize that most family leaves, medical is your own sickness. You have a heart attack, you're out till you're better. But if you are taking off time because your mother or father had a heart attack, you need a week or two to get them settled. So 80% of family leaves, other than bonding with a new child, are over in 10 days or less. So if the first week is unpaid, you're not talking about a huge incentive for people to go out and cheat on this. It's only partial wage replacement. It's not full wage replacement. In California, it's 55% of wages, but then up to over $800 a week. In New Jersey, it would be two-thirds of wages, but we have a lower count. And there are no new job protections. This is the other thing. Well, I'm a small business, and if somebody has a sick parent has to take off, I can't get the work done. I'm going to have to, If you have an employee whose child has leukemia and says, listen, I have to take time off, and you say, you know what, you're fired, if a kid with leukemia, you're fired, you can still do it. Well, what is the reason that that employee should not be able to collect partial wage replacement from an insurance fund for 12 weeks while they're getting themselves back on their feet? It didn't come out of your pocket. It doesn't cost you anything. You can still fire them, and they can still collect partial wage replacement. And basically, I've been on panels with employers, and they are out of things to say at the end of the day.
Can you tell us where do things stand in New Jersey? How far along? I mean, there's legislation pending, and
these things are like so. I hate to discuss them publicly. Yeah, we worked so hard to elect Governor Corzine because he was in favor of all these things when he was in the Senate. But if he would say one word, we would be in good shape. We have a bill that has been written. We have a powerful, powerful state senator who, with one word from the governor, would introduce this, and it would then pass overwhelmingly. But we don't have that one word. So our coalition is very well organized, and we're still hoping that that senator will drop this bill soon. If not, we have other less powerful women, shall I say, as opposed to this powerful man. Anyway, we certainly have women in both houses of our state legislature ready to introduce this whenever we say that's what we really need, and then we'll be into struggle mode. But the legislation has been written, and we've costed it out. You know, we know what it will be. I would say one last thing about the slow cost. There are five states which have temporary disability insurance, and they are California, New Jersey, New York, Hawaii, and Rhode Island. In those states, the add-on for family leave is very, very, very low. In the states that do not already have it, they will have a hard time starting with 12 weeks because you've got to build up the system first. It will not be as cheap in a Washington state as it is in California.
Actually, my recollection was that there was recently a study of the California paid leave system, which basically found usage was lower than expected and the costs were lower than expected.
That is correct. We all anticipated, and at first in New Jersey too, we budgeted for 3% because we know the 3% report, 3% of workers report that they've taken a family leave. But only 1.5% claimed the insurance. And there are three reasons for that. The first is, if you're a professional, these leaves are over mostly, 80% of them are over in 10 days or less. So if you have paid vacation, you can get 100% wage replacement. You just think, so if you're a professional or a manager and you have to take a family leave, you don't call it a family leave. You just say, look, I want to use some of my vacation leave right now. And so we think that they're not taking it. The second thing is the first week is unpaid. If the leave is over in 7 or 8 days and it's just partial wage replacement, it might not be worth it. So you have to do paperwork and apply to the state for this. It's not something you just go into the HR office. So it may not be worth it to you to do the paperwork to apply to the state to get that replacement. We're talking about very little money. And the third is we're working really, really hard to get the word out to Kate's main people that we hope to have as help. And we don't know how many of them do know about it and are actually using it, but we hope to get those numbers up somewhat. It will still be incredibly cheap. I mean, we budgeted for a much larger number of people taking it. They're running surpluses now in California, even at this low premium rate.
I think even in Massachusetts, though, which is establishing this strong family fund in lieu of something that's already existing like PDI, it's still only $2.50 a week for higher earners and $1 a week for minimum wage earners. And it's a 12 weeks paid, $7.50 a week maximum. So I think it can be done.
Absolutely, absolutely. I just wanted to say the low New Jersey numbers might not work in your state, but sure, it's not high. I can just tell you, PDI puts me, I'm at the top of the income scale for this, puts me $240 a year. Wow. The PDI, the medical leave part of it. Mm-hmm. So we're not talking huge numbers, you're right.
Heather, did you want to say something?
No, I wanted to move on a little bit. So, given the experiences that you guys have had in New Jersey and at the national level, I mean, A, these things are cheap. They pull well, right? So we can do them. People want them. There's a lot of activism and energy going on in terms of people are trying to push them. Two questions just always emerge in my mind. Like, why aren't we moving faster? And why do these remain partisan issues? I mean, it's between both Republican and Democratic families have kids and have to struggle with these work and family issues. Would some of you like to
Did everybody hear the question? I guess just so everyone knows, I guess the question is, why haven't we passed all of these things, and why does there seem to be still be some partisanship to these issues? And so whoever wants to jump on that.
I mean, the main opposition comes from the business lobby. It's not really coming from business. If I ever, I go wherever I'm invited to any business group to speak about this, and generally speaking, if I can, they give me the 10 minutes to explain the whole thing, they can see that this is an advantage for them. It's an advantage for small business. In a state like New Jersey, where we have a lot of the best companies for women to work for, it's really hard for small businesses to recruit top women, because we have J&J and Colgate and Deloitte and Touche and Wachovia. That's where the women will go. But if you can say, well, you know, we have in the state, I may not be able as a small employer to afford these benefits, but you have them because we're in New Jersey, this is a big help. So the businesses themselves can see it, but the business lobbyists are opposed to anything. That they simply want no mandates is one thing, and just to be a little blunt about it, they use the fact that we want to push for something like paid family leave as it's a fundraiser for them. Mm-hmm. Send us money, we're going to defeat this mandate. You don't want a mandate. So it's as simple as that, in my opinion. There's strong opposition from the business lobby.
Well, can I just quickly say that when we were working on the Family and Medical Leave Act, one part of our strategy was reaching out to the progressive employers, there are a coalition of them, reaching out to the employers who are already doing, these kinds of things in the workplace, providing good sick leave, providing, parental leave. Also, reaching out to, the women business owners. There was, an active strategy. I mean, it wasn't, and so that actually created a bit of leverage so that it wasn't just the Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, et cetera. It wasn't everybody against us. We did have some coalitions of, they were smaller coalitions, but we, leveraged them for as much as we could get to, make it seem like it was at least a debate on the employer side.
Right.
And, but it was hard work. I mean, not to underestimate it, and you really had to cultivate, because the business folks are, even the employers who are doing great things, the employers who, like to consider themselves progressive on these kinds of issues, they are very reluctant to either criticize their colleagues, or to be perceived as somehow breaking ranks. But we were able to do it, and so I guess
right.
Hopefully,
important.
You can.
All the state groups I think are working on that, but I thought it's very important.
Sorry, I guess
I'm taking.
Okay.
Just a second, what Michelle said—that's one of the strengths that we were looking at is how to reach out to those businesses again and take things one step further. We have FMLA that's been able to help 50 million Americans since it was passed, but we need to go further and take things and offer some of the other things that I've been looking at. So that's really the piece that needs to happen. In thinking about the answer to the question of, why it's taking so long, I think definitely the opposition of businesses is there. And one thing that we've come across when we talk about pay sick days is, we can't do this. We can't even handle our health care costs from the end of small businesses or businesses. I think if we found a comprehensive solution to health care, then perhaps they would be in a better position to what they perceive as other mandates.
All right, well, luckily we're not talking about healthcare today. That will be a whole other series that will, okay, at least a 10-parter, and sort of like the long saga. So anyhow, at this point, unless there are other questions, just want to, I think on behalf of all the congressional staff, want to thank the Center for Economic and Policy Research for organizing this whole series. It's really been, I think, very inspiring for all of us. And, and I think it's, just motivating for all of us to be with other people who are thinking about these issues, care about these issues. I know Heather wanted to say a few last words, then we'll
thank you. Thank you so much, and thank you to just a fabulous, fabulous panel. I knew it would be brilliant. And thank you all for coming. A couple of things. One, as I said at the end of every briefing, audio files and photos and all of the handouts And presentations from the whole series is available on our webpage, as well as pictures from today's events and last time's event. So if you want to check that out, it's at www.cfer.net. And again, thank you to all of the offices and, of course, to the Casey Foundation for funding this, and to all of you for coming.
All right, to be continued after the election.
Yeah, definitely.